Mini episode 746 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 746. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris. We have a tremendous guest with us today. This could be a really, really interesting conversation. Someone who has been on two very diverse career paths throughout his life. I speak, of course, of actor-turned-minister David Stambaugh. He initially came to prominence in the Bad News Bears franchise of the mid to late 1970s as Toby. And from there, subsequently, after a number of years, decided that the acting path really wasn't for him, and subsequently has ended up as a man of the cloth at this point in time. So a very, very interesting journey. Want to talk about what he was doing then, what he's doing now. Pleasure to welcome to the show, David Stambaugh. Welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Rick. Thanks very much. Great to be here with you guys.
Great to have you on. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this. I knew that this would be a very, very interesting conversation from the whole path that you have taken through the course of your life. And I know that going back to the beginning of your acting career there with the Bad News Bears movies in the late 1970s, talk about the casting process, how you got involved in the first place. I've read some accounts where you've been talking about what was up with that and how you came to be a fixture in these movies.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, the Bad News Bears came across my path, so to speak, actually after I'd been in acting for about 10 years or so. I actually started doing a soap opera when I was very young. I did a soap opera called Love of Life that was filmed in New York City at CBS. Mm-hmm. I started on that when I was about 5 years old. Did that for about 10 years. Did a number of other commercials and television movies and things like that. And so somewhere around 11 years old, this audition for a film called The Bad News Bears comes along. And at that time, you know, as you can tell, other than, you know, maybe Tatum O'Neill and Jackie Earle Haley and certainly maybe Alfred Lutter, you know, a lot of us on the team were not very well known at the time. And so they did what they would call a cattle call where every agent in town would send, you know, everybody they had from 9 to 12 years old. And my understanding is about 2,000 people auditioned for that film between New York, Chicago, Dallas, and L.A. And so it took a number of calls and callbacks and some time playing some ball in Central Park with the director and some of the folks involved in the film. One of the auditions, it's almost become kind of one of my favorite stories to tell. One of the auditions, one of the callbacks, probably my third or fourth callback, I actually was playing Little League at the time, one of the kids that actually played Little League and had some ball playing experience. You know, we were in the playoffs during the audition process, and so I was like, I can't go. I've got to play. The team needs me. And so part of me would love to think that somewhere in the producer's mind, you know, they said, oh, we got to have this kid. He's the real deal. So sure enough, I ended up on the team. And I just had a great run with the franchise.
Method acting at its finest. You got them to believe you as a legitimate baseball player. It worked out for you in the end.
Absolutely.
Well, with any kind of franchise, with anything like that, of course, they're going to be bringing in a bunch of kids who, again, don't have a tremendously high profile, although, as you point out, number of years on national television doing some commercials. You weren't exactly coming from zero on that. But as far as a high public profile, really, the magnet for this thing in the eyes, I'm sure, of the producers and everyone else was Walter Matthau. And, again, I've read some accounts that you have made of what it was like to deal with him, because there's a lot of public personas out there of where you can look at somebody and kind of think that you know him. And A lot of times that proves to be wrong, of course, but for anybody who might have thought that he would be a guy who would be very comfortable in his own skin and really kind of a generous kind of a guy, that was really the account that I read that you gave of what it was like to deal with him in real life.
It really was, you know, and I think there's, you know, there's a lot to be said for that because, you know, one of the first kind of mythic rules of acting is, you know, is you don't work with animals or children. And here right. he is, you know, stepping into this role with 12 children, you know, 12 kids that, you know, potentially could get in his way or spoil the fun. And he was nothing but generous, nothing but polite, nothing but a gentleman. You know, again, this is an 11-year-old, you know, recollection. You know, who knows what happened after my bedtime, but he was absolutely tremendous and professional with us and was a wonderful, wonderful man to work with.
Well, great to hear that he was such a great man in real life as well as being a great actor. And again, the movie, the original one, has risen to a little bit more prominence this year, as is sometimes the case with anniversaries, 40th anniversary. I think the MLB Network has been replaying it. I've seen it come across there a few times. So thinking back to that time and place, for all that people tend to associate the mid-70s as this big period for the auteurs out there and for a lot of the really creative things that were happening, and there were a lot of them, but that was where ultimately as well you started to get the two big templates coming into play here, whether it be the popcorn movies with Jaws and ultimately with Star Wars, or the sports underdog movie. There was you guys and there was Rocky. And it wasn't the first sports movies, of course, but this whole genre of the underdog movie, we come to associate those movies as sort of being the tent poles and everything that's come after it. So 40 years on, as you continue to see things and you know, having been part of, you know, the original franchise there, what are your thoughts as, I'm not going to say exactly remakes of Rocky or remakes of Bad News Bears, but so much that borrows from them. Do you kind of get the sense after watching all these years that it's kind of a played-out trope, or do you find yourself admiring new ways that people kind of reinterpret it? I'm curious to think what somebody thinks who was part of the original here well before this risk getting beaten into the ground.
Well, I think, and that's a great question, and it's really, really hard to believe that it's been 40 years since that movie came out. You know, 1976 in many, many ways for me seems like yesterday. And I don't think any of us had any idea, those of us who were involved in the making of this movie, that there would still be people that were even interested in talking about it 40 years later, you know, let alone, as you say, being a real template for how these kind of movies are made now, you know, whether it's an underdog movie or a sports movie or the best of, you know, kind of the best of both worlds. I think this movie is still being talked about, I think, because of its authenticity, because of the way it reflects real life, not only 40 years ago, but, you know, but even today in many ways in terms of, you know, competition and children and adults and what that relationship is like. There have been so many movies made that, like you said, Bad News Bears sort of fall sometimes into a list of sports movies or a list of baseball movies or a list of underdog movies. I know that one of the articles that have come out this year said that they thought Bad News Bears was one of the best sports movies ever made, not only baseball, but sports movies, just because of the realness of the movie and the authenticity, the characters. You know, the way, you know, this is going to be a spoiler alert if you haven't seen it yet, but we lose in the end, you know? I mean, that's just, you know, that was one of those things that wasn't done back in the day. And so to have that sort of real piece of life, that sort of slice of life that, you know, sometimes that's the way it ends, I think has really helped it stick around. And it's, I get to watch it, at, you know, every so often, like you say, MLB, runs it now and then, and everyone that I talk to, you know, says it's a movie that still stands up. You know, we all have seen those 70 movies that are still very 70s, but this is one that is still kind of rings true even today.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of elements of it that are timeless, and by the way, again, as far as the spoiler alert part, my sympathy is kind of a little bit minimal out there for anybody who hasn't seen it and wants to cover their ears, because it was 40 years ago now. Yeah, I'm the same guy that yells at people not to talk about The Wire in front of me, so I suppose some people might say there's some hypocrisy on my part. But 40 years, yeah, I think we can feel free to discuss the intricacies of it. You talk about the timeless elements of it. There are some, and then there are some that are very much of a place in the mid-70s, particularly, again, as has been remarked on, that when there have been remakes of movies subsequently, and you know, Billy Bob Thornton, when he was playing a version of Buttermaker, if you will, subsequently, some of the rough edges are getting sanded off, because that's the nature of today's society, and we're a little bit too sensitive for some of the language that's used in there. So some of the authenticity and some of the rawness of the Bad News Bears stuff, which is, again, part of what really kind of thrilled me as a kid in watching these movies, some of that stuff's gone. So what are your thoughts about how society has changed in the 40 years since, and about how you'd have to kind of water down some of the ways that people were expressing themselves in that movie?
Another great point about a movie that's still being talked about 40 years later. Up until before I knew they were going to make a remake of the movie, I would always tell people that, you know, it was a movie that you couldn't make these days because of that language, because of the, you know, the jokes and the political correctness that's kind of around. I would say you couldn't make that movie these days. And you know, all due respect, you know, to the remake, I don't really think that was our movie. It was certainly a different version or another approach, but it wasn't the one we made, because you're right, everything has become a little bit more careful, you know, a little bit more focus group driven, a little bit more, you know, correct. You want to, you don't want to offend. And I certainly understand that. And our movie certainly was of a place and a time where that was not the case, when you could get away with some of that language. And I always tell folks, you know, these days, who find out that I'm in the film and they say, oh, I've got to show my kids that movie. You know, I'm very quick to grab them by the shoulder and say, hey, listen, do me a favor. Order it on demand, maybe from, you know, the TV version, or if you're going to rent it or download it, you know, make sure you watch it first, because depending on how old their kids are, you know, it is very possible that it might be inappropriate. If you remember, I'm pretty sure that was a PG movie. They didn't have PG-13. They didn't have, you know, all the small little dichotomies of movie ratings. So I make sure if people are going to watch it with little kids, I make sure to put that disclaimer in there as well.
That's a great point. And with all the talk these days about college students, a lot of them needing safe spaces on campus, I dare say if you showed the original Bad News Bears, you'd have a lot of shocked people clamoring for a chance to crawl into their safe space to kind of recover, because, yeah, it's not a movie that's for the overly sensitive at heart, no question about it. You know, the Tanner monologues alone, I think, would be enough to horrify a lot of people. But, again, that's what made it so funny and really so interesting in a lot of ways, is that everybody was willing to kind of go there and make this kind of a movie, and then subsequently franchise. So it kind of plays out from the original for the next couple of years. And, again, a parallel journey for all of you that are in it, as you're all at that point getting older and having to make the decision about whether you're going to stay in acting or not, which, again, for a lot of people in the business is no decision at all, particularly for somebody who had spent as much of his life as you had in it. I know it wasn't a straight line going from there into the ministry, but first talk about what the thought was as far as not continuing to pursue the business and to get out and do something else.
Well, the decision that I made was one that probably took a couple years. It wasn't really necessarily a split-second decision, but one that kind of evolved over time. You know, a lot of folks, you know, that are acting or continue to act, like you say, it's a decision that maybe is made for them or one that they don't have to make. But for me, being a relatively kind of known commodity, certainly, you know, at that time I was no Matt Dillon, I was no, you know, Michael J. Fox, you know, people weren't calling me up to be in their movie. I was still auditioning a lot, and so what happens is, you know, eventually you get to high school and first of all, you know, puberty just does a number on you. You know, you look funny, you sound funny, not real attractive on the camera. And so after high school, I knew that I wanted to go to college. So there's another 4 years of not really working. And then after college, you don't really know where you want to go. And all of a sudden, it's, you know, it's been 10 years since you've done something. And so at that point in my life, I must say I was very lucky. I was very blessed to have a career that I would say kind of fell into my lap. You know, I wasn't out there, you know, jumping at the bit to kind of get into this when I was five. Someone came up to me on the street. You know, my folks, you know, were walking down the street and said, "Hey, how'd you like to do a commercial?" So I was kind of discovered in that way, you know, and kind of got in acting through the back door. And so I was grateful for a wonderful career, but it wasn't one of those things that kept me up all night, that consumed me. And to reach any amount of success in that business, that's something that you have to have. You have to have that drive and determination, that, you know, whatever it takes kind of attitude. And I just, you know, I just really didn't want it that bad. Don't get me wrong. If an agent calls me as a result of this interview and says, "Hey, how'd you like to come do a movie?" I could get some vacation time from my church, I'm sure. But for me, then that change just kind of shifted, and I went to a couple different things, sort of tiptoed into the ministry, so to speak, and then I just kind of found myself interested in that type of work and that type of education, and went on to school, and then subsequently, you know, working at different churches around the country, and I found that to be, you know, very, very rewarding work for me.
And then subsequently, right now, as a minister of faith formation at Greens Farms Church, of course, greensfarmschurch.org is where information can be found about that. So up there in Connecticut, talk about what the journey was to getting there specifically, what your job involves with that, and some of the things that drew you to it in the first place.
Absolutely. I spent most of my early career in the ministry in New Jersey, kind of grew up in New Jersey, mm-hmm. and then around and spent a number of years there. My first three churches were all in New Jersey, and my theological education was in the New York and New Jersey area. And so spent a good number of years there, and eventually found my way out to California. Spent a number of years out in California at a wonderful church in Hollywood United Methodist Church, a wonderful church that's doing some wonderful social justice work, with a wonderfully kind of progressive theological message, and had some good friends out there. Was able to actually, interestingly enough, you want to talk about, you know, two paths crossing, able to connect with some of my old friends from the Bad News Bears and some of the cast and crew. Was able to see them, and it was interesting. We were out there, my wife and I were out there for about 7 years, and had a great, great time. But we're sort of the age now where parents are getting old, and nieces and nephews are growing up and going on to high school and college. And so because all of our family and friends were back on the East Coast, we decided it was kind of time to move back. And so so both of us, my wife actually first, and then I kind of followed suit, found some work in the Connecticut. We're involved with a denomination called the United Church of Christ, which is very prevalent here. It's almost like finding the Carl's Jr. in Southern California. You know, if you want to be in the United Church of Christ, this is kind of where it all started, in the Massachusetts and Boston area. So there's a number of opportunities here, and we both found some great work here. And most of my ministry career has been sort of faith formation or spiritual direction, that sort of a teaching ministry and adult education. And so I've got a wonderful opportunity where I can be doing some teaching and some preaching with a great new church and I shouldn't say new church. It's a church that's been around over 300 years. But a new church for me with a wonderful new staff and in a wonderful area of Connecticut. It's beautiful up here. And even though I've been on the East Coast for, you know, most of my life, boy, oh boy, the trees change color around here, and it's fascinating, a lot brighter and brilliant than I seem to remember in California. But then again, I've been in the desert for the last 7 years, so any color looks really nice to me.
Yeah, the colors are going to pop a little bit more once you get out of there, no question about it. But
yes, sir.
Something I'd like to pick your brain on from sort of a macro perspective here about religion and society today. Now, me personally, I come from a pretty traditionalist perspective. I'm a lifelong Roman Catholic. One of the things that I have observant, and I wouldn't say you'd have to be Einstein to necessarily assert this. It's a fairly obvious thing, is that when you're looking at millennials, it's a generation that not only is a lot more secular, I think it's safe to say, is not even really conversant with a lot of spiritual and religious perspectives, much less so than most of the generations that have come before. So what kind of challenges do you find are inherent in that, in dealing with younger people who, I get the sense, may sort of kind of gape openly at you if you start talking about some of these concepts?
Well, what I have found over, you know, the life of my ministry, and I would absolutely agree. I mean, I don't think it certainly doesn't take a rocket scientist or a brain surgeon to simply look at the numbers, certainly in the mainline denominations, and see that that they are shrinking. You know, less mm-hmm. and less people are going, less and less people are attending or joining. You know, I think, I can't remember if it was a Pew research study, I can't remember, but, you know, for one of the first times as long as surveys have been taken, you know, people who identify as the nuns in terms of religious affiliation, N-O-N-E, not N-U-N,
yes,
but N-O-N-E, you know, they've got no real affiliation, you know, either their parents kind of stopped going or eventually they didn't go. What we have found over certainly the life and experience that I've had doing sort of community outreach work and social justice work and disaster relief work is while these folks may not be motivated by going to church and being involved in a spiritual life on going through the front door of a church, many, many, many of them are interested in going through what's called, you know, in some vocabularies, the side door of the church. If you can involve someone in a service project, whether that's a neighborhood beautification project or a Habitat for Humanity or, you know, helping with disaster relief around the country or mission projects like that, young people are very attuned to that sort of need that the human being has. I mean, I think we deep down in our hearts kind of want to help each other and care for each other. And so many churches and many of those millennials, as you say, are, I think, interested in doing that sort of thing. So if you can reach them through that specific avenue and get them to come to the church through the side door, they may not be there on Sunday morning at 10, but they might be there on, you know, Saturday afternoon to do a Habitat for Humanity house build or to help put together disaster relief packages for flood victims in Louisiana or earthquake victims in Italy, whatever it is. I have found that's what sort of primes the pump, so to speak. That's what kind of gets the engine going. And then you can say, well, the reason we do this is because, you know, one of the things Jesus said, actually the most important thing Jesus said was, the big picture, we love God and we love our neighbor. So this is one of those ways that we can live out that great commandment of loving our neighbor by serving them and showing them God's love in a practical way.
Absolutely, and that seems to be a big part of the strategy that's being deployed by Pope Francis as far as his thoughts on how the reversal in the numbers can be achieved with the Roman Catholic Church. That's certainly been his imprint that he has put the last couple of years on this. So when you're talking about going in that kind of direction and that these kind of strategies have proved to be apparent, when you have the highest profile, I would have to say, religious leader in the world talking along the same lines, even though, of course, you're not in the Roman Catholic Church, are you sensing any parallels as far as in your line of work of people learning to sort of think more along these lines and of this kind of strategy for bringing people in? Does it seem to be taking root in any way because of any of the things that Pope Francis is doing to elevate that message?
I think you've really hit on a great theme there, because, you know, it didn't take long for people to fall in love with Pope Francis. I mean, people that who aren't Catholic, who have never been Catholic, or even those, you know, angry ex-Catholics, you know, everybody seems to love this guy. And so that idea of being able to kind of think alike and work together on things like that, I think is exactly right. One of the themes or mottos of the United Church of Christ, of which I'm a part, which brought together very differing denominations. If you go back and look at where, you know, the United Church of Christ came from, they came from a number of different theological spectrums, and the theme is one of Jesus' prayers in the Gospel of John, you know, that they may be one. You know, that they may be one, is that sense of unity that the United Church of Christ is working on. And you can see over the years there have been a number of sort of inter-religious dialogues, interfaith dialogues of folks that have wanted to bring that together and wanted to unite the sort of different streams, you know, again, as a witness to the fact that there's really probably more that unites us than what separates us. And you're always going to have your naysayers. You're always going to have your dividers, the people who, you know, say my way or the highway. But I think the goal of the ministry is that we would certainly work together to take care of each other and to take care of our planet.
And there has been, as you say, a lot more interfaith dialogue, a high profile level over the last couple of years, no question about it. As far as any of the faiths, I would say that would have been in the general vicinity. Something I wanted to ask you about is I know that your church geographically is not too far from Newtown, Connecticut, where the Sandy Hook massacre unfortunately took place a couple of years back. So that would have obviously touched the path of any denomination that had people involved in that. So was there anybody that was in your church that was affected directly, or, I mean, indirectly, obviously, it's a big thing of sadness for the community, but were there any people that were very much directly involved in that vis-a-vis having a friend or family member who was killed?
Not that I'm aware of. Interestingly enough, not in my church in Connecticut. In my church in California, as a matter of fact, however, there was a young lady who was in California working, you know, in the entertainment industry, as a producer who's actually from Connecticut and from that area. And so she came, you know, back, if you remember, I think it was right around Christmas time, maybe mid-December, if I recall correctly. So when she came back to California after, you know, her sort of break, she was, you know, really moved and really affected. There are certainly a number of, you know, churches in the town in the town at that time and the surrounding area at that time that sort of came together and worked to kind of support and do whatever they can. And I know that in the months and years since that, there have been a number of kind of social awareness campaigns on gun violence and not necessarily I'm not talking about a Second Amendment issue, but just gun safety and kids and children and how all that works together and what we can do to prevent that. So in a weird sort of way, even though I'm here in Connecticut now, it was actually when I was working in California that I had kind of the most connection to that tragedy, but it was something that still echoes and still rings true and still, is almost a palpable thing when you drive through that area or you know people in that area. It's still a very delicate, sad subject that people are still very passionate about.
No question about it. Some scars take very, very long times to fade, if they ever do, and certainly something like Sandy Hook, just the amount of horror and tragedy that was inflicted upon an unsuspecting community. Yeah, that's the healing process. Full healing is probably still many years off. But it's the role of churches such as yours with Green Farms Church. Of course, can be found at greenfarmschurch.org with the great work that you guys are doing and other members of the faith community, obviously, that must make it somewhat easier for them to be able to get through. So I just want to say, David, as much as I was anticipating this discussion today, it actually exceeded it. It was really, really tremendous. And again, for a show that tries to go as broad as we do, I get a little bit greedy sometimes, and I tend to think about the areas that we don't hit as much. And some of the things about the faith perspectives, I think, could probably be put in that category. So certainly would love to catch up with you subsequently on the show, continue to get your thoughts. You really brought a lot to it, and I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Rick. It's been a great couple minutes for me as well. I've enjoyed kind of learning a little bit more about what you do, and glad to add my name to that long list of illustrious guests you've had on the lounge as well. The one thing I will say, I did happen to notice that in your, I believe it's the 2009 Pantheon, I did notice that Bull Durham was actually the favorite movie there. So maybe we can move that in this next election cycle. But I'm happy to come back and join you anytime you need.
Well, I tell you what, I refuse to lie to people on this show. So as much as I could sit here, and of course it could always be disproven by going back and listening to what we actually said, so it wouldn't get me anywhere to lie. I voted for Miracle, for what it's worth. I'm sorry about that.
There you go. That's great.
That's how much I love Miracle. What can I tell you?
It's been great to great to be with you tonight. Thank you once again for the invitation, and look forward to the next time.
Thank you again for the conversation, sir. Really, really appreciate it. Great chance to catch up here today. The great David Stanball, everybody, actor turned minister, and of course you can find everything about him at www.greensfarmschurch.org, greensfarmschurch.org, where he is minister of faith formation, talking about his work there. Thank you so much, David, for being a part of the show today, and thank you, everybody, for listening to FDH Lounge mini episode number 746.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.